Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks. I mean machinery. I've never seen so many knobs. We're going to have to do something, Charlie. Try pushing that button now. No? How about that one?
Try pushing that button there. It might give another 100 votes to Donald Trump. Nice going. You've downloaded the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today I'm joined by election integrity activist Jonathan D. Simon, the author of Code Red, the man who has analyzed the election results and identified the red shift. That's the expression of the difference between the exit polls that show Hillary Clinton won, for example, in North Carolina, and the official tally, which declared Donald Trump the winner in North Carolina. This is evidence of potential election fraud. It is the basis for some of the recounts that are underway under the auspices of Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Jonathan's going to help us understand these issues, and while it may not change the outcome of this year's election, it could help identify the real problems in our election process. I think you'll find this fascinating. And I want to thank Arlene Montemirano. She's a loyal listener and subscriber to the Peter B. Collins podcast, who emailed me the other day and said, "Why don't you talk to Jonathan Simon?" Now, she wasn't the only listener who suggested that. But I want to thank Arlene and others. I welcome your input to the program and ideas for guests or topics to discuss. You can join Arlene and become a subscriber. Go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. And from there, you go to the sign-up page where you can choose the level of support that's comfortable for you. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all who support my work here at peterbcollins.com. Donald Trump claimed victory on election night and Hillary Clinton conceded. But Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein has authorized some recounts in critical states. We're going to talk about it with Jonathan D. Simon. A little rock and roll political satire from Alice Cooper from back in the Nixon era, 1972, I Want to Be Elected. And as we look at the post-election landscape here, there have been some interesting new developments. As I mentioned, Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, has authorized recounts in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And each landscape presents different challenges to the recount. And to get some commentary on this, we turn to Jonathan D. Simon. He is an expert on political polling. He is the author of Code Red, Electronic Election Theft and the New American Century. And he is joined together with some people I have great respect for at recountnow.org. Jonathan, thanks for being with me today.
Okay, Peter, great to be here. Thank you.
Now, you must be pretty busy because you've been crunching numbers since the day of the election. And in my first post-election interview that I did with Greg Palast, we cited your work on the red shift, and that has caused many people to examine the results and ask questions. So, Jonathan, as we look at this right now, how would you lay out the overview with the recounts that have been requested by Jill Stein in these three critical states?
Well, you know, Yogi Berra famously said deja vu all over again, and this in many ways resembles what happened in 2004, only the red flags are a bit brighter, actually more egregious. So we're looking at a pattern of red shift in the exit poll to vote count comparison that is very strong, very pervasive, but concentrated disproportionately in battleground states that would be the putative targets for manipulation. So that overall is a very strong forensic pattern, red flag pattern.
And Jonathan, let's just recap for listeners who may not have focused on the 2004 election. You and many other people, Bob Fetrakis and others, did an extensive look at those results. And Richard Hayes Phillips authored a book detailing the really bizarre and brazen efforts that did succeed in flipping that election from John Kerry to George W. Bush. And many people don't really recognize that because the corporate media didn't embrace it the way they did the challenge to the results in the year 2000. But I firmly believe that the election was stolen in Ohio in 2000, and it was the variation, the differential between the official count issued by the Secretary of State and the exit polls that gave us the first indication of that. And you and others have repeatedly stated that when there is this kind of discrepancy between the official account and the exit polls in third world nations, the United States demands a new election. Oh, like in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, if this same electoral profile, if the same election and the numbers that came out of this election had come from another nation anywhere in the world, the United States would have been in there pretty much on the spot, calling for investigation, calling for recount, challenging the legitimacy of the election, calling for an electoral redo, assuming that the person that they wanted to see win had not won, in geopolitical interests aside. Furthermore, if it had been reversed, if we were in a parallel universe and all these numbers were exactly reversed and we were looking at a blue shift in the exit polls, you know, from Clinton to Trump, as opposed to the other way, Trump to Clinton, as opposed to the other way around, and Clinton were now the president, you can bet your bottom dollar that Donald Trump, who before the election was already warning about the possibilities of rigging, would have refused to concede, and we'd probably be seeing the Million Gun March on Washington to protest this, and all sorts of filings in the courts, not to mention, you know, the tweet storms coming every night. Of course, once Trump won, he was very satisfied with the integrity of the electoral system, which is unfortunately the way it tends to work in politics. I'm still waiting for a sore winner to come forth and say, you know, that was a close election, and it seems like the people voted for me, and I have a majority of the votes, but I don't feel fully confident in the counting process, and I want the people to know that they've elected me, and I want to know myself that I've been elected, so let's have a full hand or observable count of these votes, and we're still waiting for somebody like that to come along. So what we generally have, you know, we have all signifiers, these red flags. They're statistical patterns that really are hard to reconcile with any benign explanations. They don't prove that the election has been stolen, but they are very, very concerning. And if we want to have a democracy that has a solid basis and that people can feel real trust as opposed to just accepting on faith, we really need to have a different vote counting system. And with the vote counting system we now have, the best we can really do are these recounts. But recognize that, you know, recounts are a very imperfect solution. We're looking at, you know, days and days and weeks, actually, where ballots have been sitting around and very often without, you know, chain of custody really being observed. A very, very haphazard process involved in the counting of them, as we're now seeing in Wisconsin, a very expensive process. And there are many, many tricks, as a veteran of former recounts, I can tell you, that are pulled to sabotage or subvert the recounts themselves. It's recount fraud. So this is not really the way to go about verifying anything. It's just the only way we have, given that we have at computerized unobservable vote counting system.
And Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, but historically, and we're going all the way back to the turn of the century, 2000, the shift has been red in its character. That is, that the discrepancy between the exit polls and the official tally has tended to benefit the Republicans. In the Democratic primary, however, in 2016, we saw these variances appear and benefit Hillary Clinton. While the Republican primaries were running close to, if not at, the margin of error in the variance between exit polls and the official tally. So before we get to the present tense of the November vote, what about the primaries? Did you have confidence in those results? And did you discover, as Richard Charnin did, a red shift in favor of Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, we were all working with pretty much the same data. I mean, the interpretation we put on it was somewhat different. Richard has rather famously written a book now, 77 billion to one. He likes big numbers. He likes to look at it purely mathematically. I have a different way of looking at it, and you kind of alluded to it. I call it second-order comparative. So you compare disparities, for instance, in battleground states versus swing states, or in Democratic primaries versus Republican primaries, battleground states versus safe states, I meant to say. So you have a baseline. You look at races that would not be riggable. There would be no point in trying to rig a race that was had a margin of 30 or 40%. You look at exit poll performance there. You look at it in the battleground states where there really is an incentive, where it is a target. You look at the Republican primaries versus the Democratic primaries. I mean, we can't really, it's above our pay grade to identify a perpetrator and say, well, this was Hillary Clinton's doing, or this was Karl Rove's doing, or this was the Russians. That's tough. That's left for the FBI and people that have more access into these systems. But we can identify that you have two radically different patterns in the primaries. And so the exit polls were pretty much spot on for the Republicans, and way off, all in the same direction pretty much, favoring Hillary Clinton. The vote counts came out more for Clinton than the exit polls, which came out more for Sanders, in state after state after state. And we had another second-order comparison. We had the caucuses versus the primary states. Mm-hmm. And after the first two caucuses, which were very, very close in Iowa and Nevada, there were 12 more caucuses held, 12 more caucus states. And that was when Bernie Sanders' campaign had kind of picked up momentum. Well, he won. Not only did he win every one of those 12 caucus states, but he won them by an average margin of 36.6%. And these were blowout wins, one after another. I think the closest one was 11%, and there were some where the margin was as much as 60%. What's the difference? Caucuses are counted basically observably by hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, it's a bit of a different set of voters. It's a more motivated set of voters. There are factors, other factors involved. But the overriding factor is caucuses are counted observably and the primaries were not. And you saw this radical divergence, and you saw all the exit polls. Now, if the exit polls were that far off, and you're going to blame it on pollster incompetence, they don't know what they're doing, you wouldn't see that they got it pretty much right down the line when they were polling Republican voters. So you look at a situation like this, and it really does look as if there was manipulation that benefited Hillary Clinton. That doesn't mean it was authored by Hillary Clinton. Doesn't even mean that she would know about it. There are a lot of actors out there, a lot of bad actors, a lot of powers, both foreign and domestic, that have a stake in U.S. elections. U.S. elections are basically the highest stakes game on earth, and it's not surprising that it would attract a lot of interest, especially given how vulnerable the process is to manipulation. So there could have been many reasons for blocking Bernie Sanders, and it could have been in the interest of seeing a Republican elected, because I think it was clear that Sanders would have been a much stronger candidate. He was way ahead in matchups with Trump, as opposed to Clinton's matchups with Trump. So he was the guy that pretty much had to be stopped. He was the only one in the whole field that posed any significant danger to corporate interests and the moneyed interests was Bernie Sanders. And he came pretty damn close nonetheless. But, yeah, the primaries had a major stench coming out of them. Sanders himself did not, you know, take up the cross challenge. Most politicians won't go there.
No, they won't. It's really frustrating, isn't it?
It is frustrating, but then again, I mean, they're the ones with the, you know, with the career to maintain, and they're the ones that could be in many different ways intimidated. We would like to see, you know, we're very proud of Jill Stein. I mean, she's certainly not doing this to gain the presidency. She's doing this because she was persuaded that there are so many concerns and uncertainties about the true outcome of this election, and besides the outcome of the election, about the ways that votes are counted in this country. I mean, it's hard to overstate how insane, how irrational it is to have this supposedly, you know, beacon of democracy that prides ourselves on our democracy, and to outsource the counting of our votes to a handful of private corporations with virtually no oversight. Those votes are counted in the deep dark of cyberspace, some of them on networked computers, some of them just on computers that have been programmed with proprietary software that nobody is allowed to inspect or see.
Right.
I mean, this is outright loony.
And don't forget,
what we've been doing for the last 15 years.
Don't forget the use still in many communities of the totally unverifiable touchscreen machines, and those create an additional hazard or hurdle to recounts, because all you can really do is rerun the tabulations, and typically garbage in, you'll get the same garbage out. But Jonathan, before we get to the redshift in the November election, I'd like you to address one issue that comes up frequently from my good friend Brad Friedman at BradBlog, and that is that he has raised concerns about these analyses because of the way exit polling is conducted in the current time frame. And that is that one company, Edison, has control of it. They don't do exit polling in every state. And they correct or massage their numbers to match the official tally as those votes are counted. So please explain to listeners as succinctly as you can why you believe the exit poll data that you capture on election day from sites like CNN.com is reliable and is not an adjusted number, but a raw, unadjusted figure.
Well, it's not a raw figure. It's a weighted figure, and it's weighted to, by a fairly complex algorithm, to the exit pollster's best estimation of what the actual electorate looks like demographically. And so, unlike Richard Sharn, and I'm not prepared to put, you know, jump in with both feet and all my weight on the exit polls and say the exit polls are gospel and we're going to calculate the odds that they'd all be this far off and it's 77 billion to one. No, I don't look at it that way. There's a lot of difficult to quantify potential distortions in a given exit poll. Response bias, selection bias, the cluster effect. Some of them are easier, some of them are more difficult to quantify. What we're looking at is when we see a pervasive pattern, and especially when we see what we call, you know, a differential pattern. So we're seeing all these exit polls that are off for one party in the primaries, but not for the other party. Or we're seeing these exit polls that are off, but very much concentrated disproportionately in the battleground states. Those are not patterns that you'd see with general exit poll issues or incompetence. Now, exit polls do get adjusted, and they wind up being congruent with the vote counts. This is why we stay up and we screen capture the exit polls before the vote counts come in. Just after the polls close, exit polls are posted, and that's relatively pristine. Is it the raw data? No. And the raw data has its own issues. It's mm-hmm. not made public. It has its own issues. We're not going to get a look at that. But what we are seeing is we are seeing weighted exit polls that have reasonable proportions of black people, white people, Latino people, men, women, age, by party identification. And the exit pollsters are really at the top of their profession. These guys have been doing it for a long time. They've had a lot of, they're fanatical about error correction. And so when you see them making what seems to be the same error over and over and over again, and they can't seem to compensate for it, that in and of itself is a major, major red flag. Mm-hmm. And so we're not working with perfect data. And I'm not ready to go out there and say, well, okay, this one was off by X and Y and Z, and we're going to multiply them all together and say this could never happen because it's a trillion to one. That's not it. It's looking at the pattern and saying that this is really not the kind of pattern you would expect to see where votes were being counted accurately and honestly and exit polls were being conducted competently.
And
we shouldn't see this pattern.
Jonathan, you're the expert here. I'm not a polling guru of any kind, but correct me if I'm wrong about this. My impression is that the most honest answers ever given to a pollster are coming from people who just exited a voting booth, and that this is reliable data. The issue is the way it is used by the television networks, and I think it's a real abandonment of their responsibility in a democracy to use the exit polls for color. All right, you know, white males without a college education came out for Trump. And then they find somebody who fits that profile and they put them on TV and say, why'd you vote for Trump? And I don't have any objection to them using the exit polls for that purpose. But it's also a very powerful forensic tool, and they appear to be intent on obliterating its use as a way of evaluating the integrity of an election.
Yeah, I mean, my first comment on that is that elections are very much a media property. In our country, we are an entertainment culture. And you got the Super Bowl, you got the Olympics, you got the World Cup, you got Dancing with the Stars, you got the elections. One of the reasons why we computerize our elections is so that the media, the major media, can put tie it all together in a bow, tell you who won, have all those blue and red blinking pie charts, and the pundits come on and analyze it all, and you can still go to bed by 11 o'clock. This is, you know, a priority that we have, as opposed to the accuracy and honesty of the election. So you have these problems that are built into that process. The exit polls themselves, the adjustment process to me has never been that big a deal, because we actually capture them before that adjustment process takes place, or before most of that adjustment process takes place. There's some subtleties. For instance, in states like Florida and Michigan, the redshift didn't look very big, and you'd say, well, okay, those states must have been honest. Well, both those states have a tiny little corner in the next most western time zone, in the central time zone. Mm-hmm. And what that means is, by gentleman's agreement, they won't release the exit polls to the public until the polls have closed in the entire state. That means they have an hour to begin the adjustment process. And we saw that by the time they released the exit polls, about 40 to 50% of the vote had been counted in those states. So we're basically looking in those cases at an adjusted exit poll. The same is true with Texas and a couple of other states. That is problematic. It is what it is, and we do the best we can with it. But we have, fortunately, enough states that just are in one time zone that we get a good run of what we would consider to be relatively pristine exit polls. And it doesn't look pretty. I mean, we got Utah with a redshift of 12%, and you'd say, well, Utah, that's a safe state. This election, it was not a safe state, because there was a third-party candidate getting close to 30% of the vote. So it was a very tight state, and what would ordinarily be bright red was one that was actually very close and would have been very embarrassing for Trump to lose. You have Missouri, you have Ohio, you have North Carolina, you have Pennsylvania, all above 5%. Wisconsin, right at 5%. These are big, big shifts, way outside the margin of error. Mm-hmm. Now, are there things that can account for them? Lying to the pollsters, response bias, whatnot. Yes, possibly, but it's not likely that all those things are going to be concentrated in this same group of really vital states, and we're not going to see it elsewhere. So, again, you know, TV and the media is generally about sound bites. This analysis has to go deeper than sound bites. So it's a very, very difficult mismatch in many ways between the work that we do and the kind of information that we want to deliver and what you get on a newscast on election night or even in the days following the election. There is also a tremendous, tremendous force out there. I don't know how conscious it is, how conspiratorial it is, but there is a tremendous bias in favor of order over truth. And it is seen that if you dig too deep into this particular sausage maker, there is the potential for a great deal of disorder. Now, we're seeing it anyway, in part courtesy of Donald Trump, in part courtesy of the Russians and the FBI. We're seeing a big spike in distrust. But the forces, the gatekeepers, you know, and it ranges from the networks to the Times to the Post to the Nation, and when I say the Nation, I mean the publication, and Mother Jones, and all these that sort of ridicule the idea that there could be a problem with the vote counting process, trying very, very hard to restore order and say what we really need is public trust in the results, whether the results are accurate or rigged or inaccurate, doesn't matter. What we need is public trust first and foremost. And, you know, for those of us who are guardians of the truth, we come face to face with guardians of order, and unfortunately for us, they tend to be in positions of power and control, and we tend to be sort of standing outside with our signs and you know, and chanting, "Let us in" or "Give us a hearing," and you know, on behalf of the people, on behalf of the public sovereignty that we are trying to protect. But the will to protect that public sovereignty among the power brokers, among the elites, is not very great, to say the least.
My guest is Dr. Jonathan Simon. He's the author of Code Red, and he's also a member of the executive committee of Recount Now, which includes our friend Bob Fetrakis, who is serving as a counsel and attorney to the Jill Stein recount, Bev Harris from Black Box Voting, Mark Crispin Miller, the professor from NYU, and also Benny Smith, who is seems like an IT expert from Memphis. And, Jonathan, now let's turn to the redshift that you identified in the results so far of the November election. And it's difficult often to recite statistics in an audio program like this. So I'm going to let people know that we're only going to talk about four critical states, and the numbers are pretty easy to follow. In North Carolina, the exit poll showed that Hillary Clinton won by 2.1%. But Trump was declared the winner by 3.8%. That is a red shift of nearly 6%. In Pennsylvania, the exit poll showed Clinton winning by 4.4%. The official tally favored Trump by 1.2%. That is a red shift of 5.6%. In Wisconsin, 3.9% was the exit poll margin favoring Hillary Clinton. The vote count showed a narrow victory for Trump with a 1% margin. That is a red shift of 4.9%. And in Florida, the exit polls showed a narrow win for Clinton at 1.3%, but the vote count flipped to the same number, 1.3% for Trump, and that is a red shift of 2.6%. So these are eyebrow-raising figures, Jonathan. And as we have discussed, they are not necessarily proof that a campaign or a party intentionally manipulated the election. But it is circumstantial evidence that there is a discrepancy, and that should cause people who want an honest election, including Mr. Trump, who claims that several million people illegally voted against him, you would think that all parties would support recounts to discover the accurate numbers.
I'm speechless, you would think. However, we live in just win, baby, America. So, you know, that would only be in a world of very high ethical standards where how you play the game is more important than winning. That's not what American politics look like. I just want to, you know, in respect to those numbers, I remember I put an asterisk on Florida. Mm-hmm. That 2.6% was probably significantly diminished by the fact that we had an hour delay in getting those exit polls. So it's probably more in line with the others around, you know, 5% shift. And, you know, it's significant because when you look at that's well outside the margin of error, and you could say, well, what accounted for that error? When we look at the national exit poll, they do a separate sample of over 20,000 voters to assess the nation as a whole. And that was relative, that was pretty close, actually came out pretty close, about a 1.5% red shift. Which could be accounted for by significant manipulation in all these battleground states, and the rest of the country would be pretty much spot on and flat. We don't have state-by-state comparisons because they've chosen not to do exit polls in 22 states, so we don't have a lot of the safe states, but we do have this national sample. And those key states that we're talking about, and some of which are, you know, being recount is being pursued, stick out like a sore thumb because, you know, instead of a 1.5% red shift, we're looking at, you know, 6%, 5% red shifts. And when you combine all those four states together, you have a sample size that's basically equivalent to the national sample size. And so you wouldn't be expecting to have three times as great disparity, and yet that's what we're seeing. So, yet again, does it prove it? No, it doesn't. It doesn't prove it. I've been told, you know, again, by the powers that be, quite personally, well, you haven't presented any evidence. And this is a direct quote: you haven't presented any evidence of irregularities. And my response to that is: you must be conflating evidence with proof. Not claiming we've presented proof, but we sure as hell have presented evidence. What the probative value of that evidence is could be subject to disagreement. But a lot of this evidence is quite strong, and especially when you couple it with some of the drill downs that people like Richard Hayes Phillips and J.Q. Jacobs have been doing, and quite a few other people this time. I got to say, when we did this in 2004, you know, it was a pretty lonely occupation, and now there are a lot of people out there, and, you know, I'm averaging out at about 500 emails a day, and quite a few of them are forensic evidence coming in from people who are, you know, actually doing precinct-level analysis and county-level analysis. And, of course, they're finding more red flags as well in terms of potentially more voters voting than there were registered voters, and shifts that really don't make any sense from year to year. Again, how do you get at this? Well, at this point, we're getting at this by doing our best as a recount and looking at paper ballots where they exist. You brought up a state like, you know, Pennsylvania, or places where they're just direct recording devices, touch screens, and there is no paper trail. There are no paper ballots. In places like that, we would hope that we'd finally be able to get a court to allow the impoundment and inspection of some of the equipment, as opposed to saying, well, that's corporate equipment. That's more important than democracy. Those are trade secrets. You can't look under any circumstances. That's crazy as well. I mean, that's an inversion of priorities.
And Jonathan,
we're hoping we can look at those equipment. I mean, we looked at Tom Brady's footballs. We looked at it for a year and a half. We had headline news: impound the footballs, impound the cell phones, impound the emails, grill people to find out whether there was 10.5 pounds per square inch or 11.5 pounds per square inch in a bunch of footballs. And you'd have to conclude, if you were from Mars and you were looking down on this planet, that this is a planet that cares more about who wins some football games than about the direction of the world itself and the leadership and policy of its most powerful nation. This is outright Alice in Wonderland, crazy inversion of priorities.
Brilliantly stated there, Jonathan. Thank you for that. That's an excellent comparison. And I think it shows that, you know, election integrity is essentially a third rail. It is too hot. to explore because of the risks to the people who have been gaming the system. And we see so much of this erroneous coverage focused on voter fraud. And I will stipulate right here that there is almost zero voter fraud occurring in this country. Yet the real issue relates to election fraud, and in particular with the mainstream corporate media, they won't touch that. They just basically accept that an election official is going to perform his or her duties honestly and with integrity. And we know that there are enough of the bad ones out there that that is a very bad presumption to make.
I'm gonna jump in on that, because it's not necessarily the election officials that we are concerned about. And yes, there are some bad ones out there. There was the Catherine Harris, there was the Ken Blackwells of the world. It's not, they're mostly trying to do a good job. The problem is our system is programmed, serviced, maintained, created by a very small handful of corporations. We know that the pedigree of those corporations has been right-wing. But even if you took that and put that aside, just that they're corporations and they're not accountable and they're not answerable. And so this whole issue has come up about, you know, is it the Russians? The Russians are coming and they could hack in. But no, they can't hack in because our systems aren't connected to the internet or whatever. They are hackable. They have, many of those computers have modems and they might as well be connected to the internet. So there is that possibility. But the way I've depicted that is to say, we're worrying about a house. We're worrying about things being stolen or moved around inside a house. And we're asking, is that house burglar-proof? Can you break in through the windows? And we're mostly saying, no, it's pretty secure. While completely ignoring, and this goes across the media from A to Z, completely ignoring the fact that seven people have keys to the front door and are already inside the house. And so the entire focus has been on this, can the Russians do it? Can the Chinese do it? Can somebody from some foreign land meddle with our election system? And at the same time, we've entrusted these private corporations who are answerable to no one and could be very handsomely paid, anybody at that corporation that has a hand in the programming of a memory card, in the programming of a central tabulator, could be paid very, very handsomely with all the money floating around politics, much of it dark, to suborn them, to say, okay, take this memory card, set it up, offset the zero counters, do whatever, it, you know, voodoo that you do, and make my guy win. That wouldn't take a vast conspiracy. That would take a couple of bad actors to subvert the entire process. And when I say the entire process, I'm not just talking about the presidency. Everybody focuses on the presidency every 4 years, and when it's an election like this, there's a big, you know, or 2004, there's a lot of stir. But the infrastructure of American politics is further down the ballot. It's in the state houses. It's in the secretaries of state. It's in the judicial offices. It's in the House of Representatives. These are very enduring bodies, very hard to get incumbents out. And once you take over, as the right wing did in 2010, and you change the rules, and you gerrymander, and you set up all these voter ID requirements that are discriminatory, and you gut campaign finance laws, and you close polling places, and you make it more difficult to cast a vote, you gain so many, let alone to conceal actual computerized theft, you gain so many thumbs on the scale that it becomes virtually impossible. And what we saw, just to give an example of that, in 2014, you had a Republican-led Congress, they had a House majority, and they had an approval rating nationally of 8%. 89 said, no, they're doing a bad job, disapprove. 8%. You know, Adolf Hitler could get a better approval rating, especially today. It doesn't get much more dismal than that. And 222 of the Republicans who held House seats and stood for re-election, two of them lost their seats. That's a re-election rate of over 99%. with an approval rating of 8%.
Mm-hmm.
That's how this infrastructure is set in stone. And, you know, Karl Rove talked and boasted about a permanent Republican majority, a 40-year dynasty, and people just said, yeah, you know, puffery. This is exactly what we've got. And again, you know, the people who voted for Trump, the discontent in this country, you can direct it this way or you can direct it that way. You can direct it to a Bernie Sanders, you can direct it to a Donald Trump. But what it has in common is that 70, 80, 90% of the public is saying there's something wrong with this picture. We're not being heard. We're not being represented. We've lost our sovereignty. That's what you're hearing. And, yeah, many of them went and voted for Trump. I don't think enough to actually win the election, but that's what happens. So there's this huge breakdown of trust in the leadership, in the political system. This was an election of distrust and disgust. And, you know, from the corporate poobah standpoint, from the elite standpoint, the people who just want to run the world and have the other people be the drones, that's exactly what you want. You want to divide the public, get them to the point of apathy, where they feel like, well, there's nothing I can do. Or trust in a demagogue who's going to go down in flames. You got them right where you want them. And it's hard for me to believe that given what we've seen and all the red flags we've seen and all the forensic data we have, that the deliberate mistabulation of votes hasn't played a significant role in this rolling coup that has engulfed this country.
Jonathan, let's turn to the recounts in the three states. In Wisconsin, Jill Stein has based it on the idea that the Russians might have hacked in. I'm very dubious about the whole Russian angle. We've seen no proof either of the hacking of the DNC, and my friends who used to work at the NSA tell me that the NSA could provide that evidence on a moment's notice if they wish to. But the Stein campaign does have to have a reason to ask for a recount, and it appears that that's what they have settled on in Wisconsin. Tell us a little bit about this and also the escalating cost of recounting in Wisconsin.
Pinning it on the Russians is probably just, it's, you know, I don't know. I can't speak for Jill or her campaign, but just looking at it as an observer, it's probably good politics. It's good propaganda. I mean, if you go out there and say, you know, Donald Trump stole it, or it was stolen for Donald Trump, or Karl Rove stole it, or, you know, some Republican institution is doing the foul play. I mean, you've immediately, you know, stuck a needle into the eye of half the country, and it becomes an extremely partisan cause. And, you know, whatever you secretly believe underneath, that's probably leading with your chin. So, I mean, the Russians do make a convenient, I mean, what we really want to do is count the ballots. And the suspicion from our standpoint doesn't come from who did it. It comes from the vulnerability and the fact that we're seeing all these forensic red flags. I mean, I don't really care who did it, but it makes a better appeal. Now, you know, the recount process is, as I said, it's not the best way to run a democracy. You want to have these ballots counted observably by humans on election night, and you'd ideally want to have a nice two-day holiday, and you'd want to have an election day itself as a holiday, you'd want to have the day following as a holiday, so we can all stay up later, participate in this process, and have trust, because somebody is there observing it and deterring the processes of fraud. We don't have that, so we're going in on these recounts for a secondary count and trying to keep things kosher and hope for the best. That having been said, there was a recount done in Wisconsin in 2011 of a state Supreme Court race that was quite prominent in national politics at the time. A lot of out-of-state money came in.
I remember.
It was Kloppenburg Prosser. And we did, basically a full statewide recount. The recount took a month. Many, many ballot bags, especially in places where there was high suspicion based on other forensic measures, came in misnumbered or unsealed. Now, these bags were supposed to be sealed, and the numbers on the bags were supposed to match the serial numbers of the ballots. When you get a whole bunch of ballots in unsealed bags or put in bags with the wrong numbers, it sure looks like somebody spread them all out on a table, added maybe 50 here or 100 there, or took away a bunch or substituted a bunch, swapped out, and made them match the machines. This is not all that hard to do, especially if you have complete administrative control at the state and county level. So that was very, very discouraging and very, very suspicious. But the whole thing cost $600,000. We went into this recount with the Stein campaign believing that the filing costs amount paid to the state would be about $1 million. We found out yesterday there was the state put its invoice out there for $3.5 million. So that's like sort of taking your car in and they say, yeah, we got to replace the rotors. It's going to be $1,000, and you come back the next day to pick it up, and it's $3,500.
Yeah.
You'd have a cow. So what's the goal of this? I don't know. You know, it could be just a little profiteering by people in the state. I mean, obviously the price is way inflated. It could also be an attempt to drain the coffers of the Stein campaign. They raised an extraordinary amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the state put forward a cost for the recount before Jill Stein had raised $6.5 million. So now that she has $6.5 million, we better make sure she can't spend it on Pennsylvania and Michigan, maybe where we're not able to cover up some of the evidence, perhaps, mm-hmm. speculating.
Right.
So we're going to drain her down. We're going to make this harder. We're going to make sure that if she does spend it on those states, she's not going to have anything left for PR. She's not going to have anything left to, let's say, extend things and go into some of the other states and file contests. It'll be too late for recounts, but there are places where you can file contests. So, I mean, it does seem to be, basically a tactical move. I can't say that for sure. I'm not on the ground in Wisconsin, but there's been certainly a lot of outrage. They have been in court today fighting two things. They've been fighting the cost, and they've also been fighting the fact that the state did not mandate a hand recount, and they're allowing certain counties, quite a few counties actually, to recount in part or in whole by machine, which basically entails sticking the ballots back through the same potentially corrupted machines that counted them in the first place, which is pretty much negates the whole point.
And Jonathan, turning to Pennsylvania, one of the challenges there is that it appears the law requires three voters in each of 9,000 precincts to request a recount on Stein's behalf. Is that going to be an insurmountable block?
Yeah, as far as a statewide recount, it is. And then, of course, you know that about 80% of the machines are not recountable. They're touch screens with no paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a couple of blocks there. I mean, I think they were able to get into a couple of hundred precincts out of it, which is a very small percentage of the total. Recounts were set up, especially in the aftermath of 2004. There was a certain amount of, tactical wisdom gained, and recounts in quite a few of these states were set up to be much more difficult,
mm-hmm.
and this is some of what we're seeing now. It's not entirely preclusive. There still may be court actions to impound equipment or challenge that particular law. That's why this gets expensive. And of course, Recount Now, we are recountnow.org is trying to solicit support and donations to not directly to the legal team. That's the Jill Stein campaign is taking care of that, but for the various experts that legal teams depend on to know the lay of the land and know what the grounds are for various things. I mean, the law firms that deal with this generally don't have the kind of specific detailed experience and background that they need. So they rely on experts, and we're trying to send experts to these states, and that's where we're primarily what we're soliciting donations and support for, and that's at recountnow.org.
Well, let me ask my listeners.
Pennsylvania, I wouldn't say, is hopeless, nor is Michigan. Michigan is actually one of the easier states to recount.
Mm-hmm.
What we're looking for is, you know, if anything in any of these states comes out hot, hard evidence hot, I think that gives a whole new lease on life to the whole questioning and challenging process. I don't know exactly where it goes from there. It would be sort of an unprecedented situation. There is the Bush v. Gore egg timer running that we found out, you know, in Florida, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
Scalia basically came up with a novel theory that because Florida was recounted unevenly, that it wasn't a statewide uniform recount, that therefore it failed on 14th Amendment grounds. And he said, well, you know, with the classic Scalia wit, you know, I'd really, really like to see you guys be able to remedy this. But, you know, guess what? The clock just ran out.
Yep.
Sorry,
mm-hmm.
Bush is president. So that is a deadline that is basically, depending on how you interpret the laws, is either December 13th or December 19th. In either case, it's coming up soon.
Yeah.
So that works against us as well. And any administrative roadblocks that are thrown in the path that require going to court and litigating, of course, are going to take more time from this process. And so we're marching into a pretty stiff headwind.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we see this as probably the best opportunity we're going to get. I mean, if we go past this situation, we're looking at Republican hegemony at every level and in most of these states and the federal government, the opportunity for electoral reform in a positive direction is very unlikely to
mm-hmm.
arise. So, of course, a lot of people are looking at, you know, land and Canada or Mexico or Greenland or New Zealand or whatever.
I like Costa Rica.
But if we
there's
stay
no
here,
army.
You know, this is our Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is where the stand has to be made, and it involves, you know, the legal side of it. It involves the forensic side of it, and also involves the spin, the propaganda side of it, the public relations side, to fight that battle and really let the American public know that this is being done for good reason. It's not a scam. It's being done for the best of reasons, and that is to strengthen and preserve our democracy.
And, Jonathan, in Michigan, it's ironic because on the day that the recount was filed for, they certified the election, declaring Donald Trump the winner by 10,704 votes out of about 4.8 million that were cast. Now, to me, that falls within the statutory recall terms that most states have on their law books. What are the peculiarities about Michigan, and where do you see opportunities for a possible shift in these numbers?
Well, I can't answer that. I don't know enough about the Michigan law, but it's quite evident that it did not trigger a mandatory recount.
Yeah.
Or a free recount on request, because otherwise that would be the direction that, you know, the Stein campaign would have gone. So whatever the law is there, it's not favorable on that score. What we're looking at in Michigan is about 90,000 or so very odd-looking undervotes, many of which are from the inner-city precincts, where they voted for pretty much everybody else on the ballot and didn't vote for president. And Michigan has straight-party voting, where you click one, you know,
mm-hmm.
the equivalent of pulling one lever, and it basically picks everybody on that, from that party. They still have that. And the theory here is that there was a lot of straight ticket voting. I mean, people didn't come in from the inner cities and say, you know what? I'm going to let Donald Trump be president. I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. He's called us all sorts of names. He basically said we're the problem in this country, you know, whether we're immigrants or we're people of color or whatever, you know, we have nothing to lose, blah, blah, blah. He's insulted us in every which way, and he's dangerous. And we're going to worry about a bunch of emails, and so we're not going to vote for anybody for president, but we're going to vote for all these other Democrats for every other office. That's a very, very, very bizarre and questionable pattern. So the thinking there may be that there was a attempt to vote straight ticket, and the machines themselves did not extend that to the top office on the ticket. And there are a whole bunch of ways of doing that. I mean, I should throw out there that if, you know, you're trying to rig an election, let me count the ways. And one way is just the optical scan parameters, the readers. You got 500,000 lines of code or so running an optical scan that scans your voter marked ballot. Well, you mark a box or an oval or whatever. The reader has to, the computerized reader inside, the program that does the reading, is parameterized, so it knows where that box is or oval is on the page. And just think about it from a programmer standpoint. If you offset the place where the machine is looking by, let's say, an eighth of an inch from where the oval or the box is, you're going to miss a lot of votes. You're not going to miss 100% of the votes because you'll catch some in the box, but if you're just off by a little bit, maybe you'll miss 10% of the votes. You're off by a little more, you might miss 15% of the votes. It looks pretty innocent. Oops. Oops. Oh, yeah, it should have been 1.37 millimeters to the left there. Oh, our mistake. Looks pretty innocent. There's plausible deniability there. But you would wind up, potentially, with a pattern, just like we're seeing, where you have these tens of thousands of really difficult-to-explain undervotes. That's where, if you do a hand recount, and preferably if you also impound a machine or two from these precincts, and that's where the forensic work now has come in to look down at the precinct level and say, which of these precincts is hot? Where do we want to go and ask, file in court, to get one of those memory cards? Have an IT expert or a team of IT experts, because it takes a lot of sleuthing. Sit down with it and churn through it and see, what were those parameters? Interesting. You got 10 precincts. They all have this problem. And all of them, just hypothetically, all the Republican boxes are parameterized right along the line of the ballot itself. But, interesting. All these Democratic ones are off by a millimeter this way. You know, that then becomes fingerprints, absolute fingerprints, just like the fingerprints on a gun that fired the bullet that killed the victim. And so we're hoping, I'm hoping, personally, I'm not quite close enough to the decision makers, but we're certainly putting our input in to say, this is the kind of stuff we really want to see. This is what we're looking for. And my guess would be that the other side, having known to the extent that they have their own suspicions about this, would be working just as hard to try to cover it up. By filing in three different states, and we would have liked to see file in seven or eight states, it makes it harder to cover up everything. You really got to get in there. So we don't know what's going on, and we're awaiting the results pretty much just like everybody else. I can't say exactly what I hope, but what I do hope is that, you know, if it comes out, it's unambiguous, and that we're not looking at a situation where the numbers match, but all the ballot bags were ripped open, because that then becomes something that's, you know, it's ambiguous, it's unactionable in many ways. You can go to court, how do you ever recover? And the difficulty of that, maybe the NSA could sleuth it out. Maybe if it were in the Ukraine, they could figure it out. But I don't believe that the will to do that exists at the levels of government here that would be necessary to do that. So I'm hoping that the numbers either come out hot or they come out ice cold with a clear protocol that observers could see was honest, and we're not looking at, you know, ripped open ballot bags and whatnot, because otherwise you're just left with that cloud of suspicion. That's what we've had for the past 15 years, and we move on. And when it comes around to the next election, it's the same deal. I mean, I think this country has to get on the stick. We got to recognize if we want a democracy, we have to earn it. Democracies are not, they're historically fragile. We were born into it. We tend to take it completely for granted. We tend to say it could never happen here when we look at, you know, subversion of it. But we know that it can historically. We know that it does. We know that human nature hasn't changed that much, you know, since all this historical record, how bad and bloody it can be. And just because we have more sophisticated equipment, more sophisticated weaponry, we look smarter, but I'm not necessarily sure that we're more ethical or wiser. So, and we've seen in this age the advantage that's been taken of vulnerabilities, whether it's doping or financial regulations or Volkswagen, all the cyber theft that's going on. You know, it doesn't bode well. And it's the kind of thing where we have to get in there and say, look, if we really are serious and we really want to have a democracy, we got to work for it a little bit. And that work is pretty modest. I mean, I've served 11 days of jury duty. It would require 4 hours per voter per lifetime. So 4 hours, one time in your life, to have our elections hand counted and observed. And, you know, is that really asking too much? And I would say it's not asking too much. And I would say that if we don't, you know, organize and demand, I mean, this has got to come from the bottom up. Nobody's giving it to us from the seats of power. They're perfectly happy with the electoral system. It put them in their seats to begin with.
Right.
So we're not getting it from them. It's going to have to be the public that organizes and makes the demand. Where does that go? General strikes, tax revolt. I mean, serious forms. I mean, things that are familiar to Europeans, but we haven't seen in this country. And when we did see it, they were brutally repressed. But that's what it's going to take, that kind of pressure to say, look, you know, we're not talking about, you know, forming a commune or bringing the Bolsheviks over. We're talking about counting the frickin' votes. That's all we're talking about. You know, we're on the side of democracy and an honest vote count. And if you're not going to give it to us, we're going to organize to take it. And if that means bringing the economy down, it means bringing the economy down, whatever it takes, because this is no longer a democracy. Public sovereignty is not respected. It's been lost. It's been sacrificed. And I don't think that's necessarily a partisan issue. I mean, it may be partisan from the standpoint of the RNC or the DNC, but for the people of this country, all those Trump voters out there, one reason they voted for Trump is they feel just as disenfranchised as the rest of us. And it is time. You know, it's the elites. It's the 1%. Occupy had it right. That, in that regard, they very much had it right. It's the 1% and the 99%. With the 1% does a pretty good job of dividing the 99% against itself. But if we wake up, we say the first thing we want to do before we set economic policy or health policy or education policy or foreign policy, first thing we want to do is restore our sovereignty. And in order to do that, we have to have an observable vote counting process, and that is our first order of business. And I, you know, if it takes a revolution, that would be too bad, because revolutions are very messy and bloody and chaotic, and certainly not the first thing you want to turn to. Mm-hmm. But I think that the public has a power. They have an economic power. We've seen what some consumer boycotts can do, where we can say, okay, we've had enough. We want something very simple. This is not rocket science. It's not putting a man on Mars. It's counting our votes. Other nations do it. Germany does it. Ireland does it. The Netherlands does it. Canada does it. I mean, granted, some of those ballots are easier to count. They're a parliamentary system, so ours will be harder. So you separate out the federal offices. You at least have the presidency and the Senate and the House and governorships counted in this way, observably by hand, and, you know, and take it from there. And this is something that we certainly can do. We have to stop thinking of elections as something that's primarily a media property where, you know, the main goal is to have it be as convenient as possible and entertaining as possible. And we can all get to bed by 10 o'clock and know who won and see all the pundits and see all the pie charts. No, it's a lot more serious than that. It's our national choice of leadership, our local choice of leadership, our policy, our direction, and we're taking a lot of the world with us, and not just humans, but the rest of the life that shares this planet with us. A lot is at stake, and we can at least invest that modicum of effort and participatory zeal to make it right.
Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you for helping us understand these issues. You can get more information on the book Code Red, which has been updated, at CodeRed2016.com. And I encourage you, if you're able, to make a contribution to RecountNow.org to support these efforts to return integrity to our elections. Dr. Jonathan Simon, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Peter. Anytime.
Well, there you have it. Another presidential election in which we have no confidence. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.